You are tuned to listener-supported KUOW 94.9 Seattle for a Wednesday, February 6th. I'm Steve Scherr. Vaughn Palmer on News from Canada coming right up. This is weekday. Later in the hour, after we hear from Julian Bond at 10:20, at 10:40, we want your analysis of Super Tuesday. And more importantly, now that it looks like the race is continuing, especially the race on the Democratic side, right into Washington State, are you going to caucus? What are you going to say? What's your pitch? How important is this to you? We're going to be taking your calls in our listener forum at 10:40. Your analysis of this Super Tuesday and this election. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent for the Vancouver Sun. He joins us every Wednesday on weekday. Vaughn, I don't know if I can tear myself away from primary fever.
Well, I was up last night way too late watching this stuff, I can tell you that. Boy, as I said to you a few weeks ago, you folks sure know how to throw an election.
Hey,
and
Peter,
Washington State is now the absolute center of attention.
Yeah, they're all, here in, I think, Louisiana, right, yeah. For this Saturday. Yeah, this is very interesting that Washington
work,
State,
right?
Is going to have some impact.
Yeah, no, it's... But it's very exciting election to watch, and from a distance, the United States has had a rough few years. I am impressed at the level of discussion around the election and the positive aspects of it. That after a rough few years, there are candidates out there who sound to me like they have a lot of ideas and a pretty high level of discussion. So that must be encouraging.
It's interesting, isn't it, that after all the years of complaints about that the campaigns were mostly about horse races and the money game, that given that those were still the focus of a lot of media attention, we had countless debates where you could listen. Sometimes foolishly, they were asked questions, but you had a chance to listen to what the candidates had to say about a number of issues.
Yeah, and I love this piece in the New York Times on John McCain that points out that when he was rolling in dough, he was doing lousy in the race. It was only after he ran out of money and got rid of his staff that he actually started to get somewhere. If that catches on, there's going to be a lot of people in the political handling business that are going to be out of work.
Are you thinking of taking the ferry over to Port Angeles and seeing the caucuses yourself on Saturday?
You know, I as a political junkie, it would be tempting to get to Seattle this weekend, but I'm busy. So,
all right, fair enough. Well, we'll tell you how it goes.
Yeah,
we'll cover it. Though, as you know, here's an interesting thing, Vaughn. As journalists, there's a debate about whether journalists should even go to caucuses, because you have to declare publicly, you have to choose a party, and that would violate the sacred order of journalism, that the oath that we sign.
What, you mean in order to cover a caucus, you've got to...
No, you can cover it, but you can't, whether we should participate or not.
Oh, I see. You mean whether journalists should be involved in politics and stuff. Well, you know, it's interesting. I cover politics, and my general rule is I do not vote in any election that I'm covering. So I haven't voted provincially in British Columbia for years because I've been covering politics in BC since the 1980s. And now that I do a fair amount of commentary and coverage on federal elections, I don't vote in those either. So I'm sort of down to voting for local Victoria City Council elections since I don't write about local politics.
Even though it's a secret ballot, it's not the notion that it's a secret ballot that keeps you from voting.
No, you know what it is? It's this knowledge that when I got up the next morning and had to write about the government and start chronicling what they've done and what they're going to do, I would always have in the back of my mind this little voice saying, you know, you supported these guys, or, you know, you were opposed to them from the beginning, so I just don't vote, and that little voice just doesn't have anything to say to me on that issue.
Hmm. All right, well, that's a debate we'll have in journalism class. For a while. It's very interesting. All right, Vaughn, we've been talking about Alberta and Alberta tar sands, and the Alberta premier walked out of a discussion about climate change last week. Now what's happening this week?
Well, you'll be happy to know that the question you asked last week has now been answered. Because last week when we talked about the Alberta oil sands, tar sands, and their massive contribution to greenhouse gas emissions in Canada, you said, what are Canadians going to do about it? Well, the Premier of Alberta has come out and said, here's what we're going to do about it. His government is going to start pouring money into technology for carbon sequestration. So you build a pipeline that connects these natural gas burning facilities where the oil is separated from the sand. You build a pipeline, you take all the carbon emissions, and you pump them underground to either underground aquifers or unused spaces underground, or you inject them, in effect, back into the area you took the oil and the gas out of. It is experimental technology. It is being tried several places at the moment. It is regarded as not entirely proven, but if it can be made to work, then there's a possibility that the province of Alberta will be able to sequester most of its emissions underground.
Yeah, well, as you say, it's an unproven technology, and one of the places that's being tried in terms of sequestration is in Illinois, where there's a big carbon, big coal-fired plant that's being built to sequester its carbon, but they keep having cost overruns, and they keep rolling back the time when it's going to be built. What's happening in Alberta?
Another experiment between, I believe, Colorado and Texas, and there is an experiment between a plant in one of the Dakotas and the province of Saskatchewan. So these are being tried. The estimate in Alberta is that it will cost billions of dollars even if it can be made to work. But if you look at the level of penalties coming and on emissions in Canada, potentially anyway, and if you look at the problems, we're going to have to do something. And if they can make this technology work, it will go a long way to solving what is currently Canada's biggest emissions problem, which is the emissions associated with oil and gas production in the province of Alberta.
All right, so how much of this is real and how much of it is a political maneuver by the powers?
Well, Alberta's in the middle of an election, and it's not clear the government will be reelected, although that's probably the best way to bet. The Conservatives have been in power in Alberta for approaching 40 years, so they're probably a good bet to get reelected. The opinion polling in the province of Alberta suggests that Albertans enjoy the lifestyle and the level of government and the level of public services that the oil and gas industry brings in. And Canadians enjoy it too, because a lot of the cash benefit of oil and gas production in Alberta flows outside the province to other Canadian provinces. So everybody likes it. But the opinion polling also suggests that everybody feels kind of guilty about it. They'd like to know that there's a way to deal with the emissions and the environmental problems caused by it. So it strikes me as a worthy experiment. I hope the technology can be made to work. But you have to be honest and say this is unproven. It can probably even if it can be made to work, it's going to be very, very expensive. Canadian oil and gas will eventually come with a premium charge associated with it, in some form or another, to help pay for this sequestration technology.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we'll see more and more of that as we talk about carbon cap and trade and carbon offsets and the like. Vaughn, let me shift topics with you. Toronto School Board has a dropout rate among black teenagers. They're worried about it, and their response is?
An Afrocentric school. A very contentious vote last week. Toronto School Board voted narrowly to establish a, quote, Afrocentric school to deal with a 40% dropout rate among black teenagers. The school district is still working on exactly how this thing will operate, but the idea is to create an Afrocentric curriculum to encourage enrollment by black students, to essentially create it. They're emphasizing it isn't going to be a separate school, but it will be a school that they hope will be more opening, more welcome, promote self-esteem, deal, as I said, with this terrible dropout rate. It is very controversial because some people say that the problems associated with the dropout rate aren't things you can solve by through the math curriculum or the literature curriculum or history. They are things, they're community and society problems that need to be dealt with outside the school system rather than in the school system.
Well, was that taken into account when they were talking about this? Is that what makes it contentious? Some people don't want to see that an Afrocentric school started, but instead apply it other ways to the problem?
Yeah, I mean, it's very controversial, and it was a narrow vote. So obviously, I mean, there's a lot of level of disagreement in the school system. There's been allegations that the school board caved to special interest pressures, to vogue theories about the education system that may not work, that it's political correctness run amok. I guess I would say that it's clear that the school board had the best of intentions in this. It isn't clear to me that this will work. Premier of the province of Ontario, Dalton McGuinty, has sympathized with the school district's objective, but he has also said that the province, which pays a big chunk of the freight in setting up an education system, the province will not be providing additional money for this. The school board is going to have to design its own school and come up with its own money.
40% of Caribbean-born black students don't graduate from high school in Canada. 32% from East Africa drop out, according to the Toronto School Board's data. And somebody said this has been going on for 30 years.
Yes, and there are, there's a whole bunch of problems associated with it, violence in the community, absent fathers, economic underclass, lack of jobs, lack of employment. I mean, you know the story. It's just the question is whether or not the school system is the place that you're going to be able to make a difference, or whether you should be dealing with some of the other problems in the community and the society, and rather than doing something to the school system that may, I mean, some people say, some education theorists say this will actually be counterproductive. Some of the debate we've seen up here around this would be, I would say, has echoes of some of the debate you've had in the United States education systems over black English, for example. If you remember that debate from about 15 or 20 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it continues in one form or another. All right, Vaughn, I left you all 40 seconds, but we teased it, so at least just tell us, what was this horse slaughter story about?
As I gather, the United States, a series of protests have shut down the country's abattoirs that were slaughtering horses for the export horse meat market. And there's a story in the Canadian paper here saying those horses are now being brought to Canada, where they are being slaughtered, and the meat is still being sent to Europe and Japan. So you have outsourced the horse slaughtering, horse meat production business to Canada.
Just part of our economic strategy.
I'm sure that's exactly what they intended, right? Anyways, good news for the Canadian slaughterhouse industry, but not for horse lovers in Canada who are threatening to protest and blockade and do all those other things.
Wow. All right, Vaughn, we'll talk to you again next week. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye.
Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent, Vancouver Sun. This is KUOW.
19 minutes past 10 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Definitive Audio. Locally owned for over 30 years, Definitive Audio specializes in the design, sales, and installation of high-performance custom home entertainment and control systems. Showrooms are located on Roosevelt Way in Seattle, on Northeast 20th in Bellevue, and online at definitive.com.
Now that we live in the future, where can a 1970s buff find satisfaction? Where can you go to get your fix of the Bay City Rollers, Tiger Beat Magazine, and Farrah Fawcett's hair? Answer, therollerblog.com. The groovy chick behind Rollerblog is known as Roller Katie. We'll talk with her about it this afternoon at 2:20. 38 degrees, overcast in Seattle. Today's high, 43. We're expecting rain today. 94.9 KUOW, news and information. Broadcasting three channels in HD and streaming online at KUOW.org. It's 10:20.
This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherr. Before Barack Obama captured the hopes of many Americans, another young black man had people inspired. At the 1968 Democratic Convention, Julian Bond's name was offered for the vice presidential post, and thousands on the convention floor chanted, "Julian Bond, Julian Bond." He withdrew his name because he was too young to serve. Today, as chairman of the NAACP, Bond continues to champion civil rights. He joins us on the phone. He's speaking at University of Washington campus, Kane Hall, tonight at 7. You remember that moment, right?
Oh, very much so. It was an exciting moment.
When you look at Barack Obama, do you feel a tinge of something?
Yes, of something. I'm not sure if I want to characterize what it is, but among other things, enormous pride in him and enormous pride in the country, which apparently has changed enough to give him consideration to be the Democratic nominee, and then, if successful, the President of the United States. And that's got to make all Americans feel good, whether they support him or not.
I was reading a long interview you did with Henry Louis Gates on PBS about the era and this present era, and you just said something that came out of that interview as well. So why is Obama different? What is it about Obama's speaking that reaches beyond just a small niche?
First, there is something about the country first. The country has changed, not enough, but has changed so that a candidate like Barack Obama can get consideration from a wider number of people than a black candidate ever could have done in the recent past. But about him particularly, he has found a kind of magic that Martin Luther King had, and that is the ability to speak to both white and black Americans in the same tone, using the same phrases, touching both, making neither feel that he or she is individually and separately because of their race being directed, that he's directing just at them. He's speaking to all Americans, and that's a tremendous gift he has, and I think that has made all the difference.
Do you know Shelby Steele from Stanford?
Met him once, but can't say I know him well.
But we talked to him last week about a book he wrote, Why Obama Can't Win, A Bound Man. He called Obama a bargainer in the African-American community, and a bargainer can't offer whites a redemption for the racism of the past, but in the end wouldn't be able to win because he can't speak truthfully to the need for responsibility among all people.
Well, I don't think that's true at all. I think Mr. Steele is locked into the notion of white guilt. It's a favorite theme of his. He's been harping on for decades and decades, and the theory is that black people, or black leadership figures at any rate, play on white guilt, make white people feel badly about segregation in the past, slavery even in the distant past, continued racial divisions today. And as a consequence, white people feel badly when black people talk about what's happened to them and what their present conditions are. I think that's nonsense. And I think that Obama isn't playing on anybody's guilt. He's playing on everybody's hopes and dreams and best wishes for the country in which they live. And he's saying to them, whatever's happened yesterday, we can build a different tomorrow, and people are responding to that.
Have you declared your support for a candidate?
No, and I can't and I won't because I'm head of the NAACP, and we're nonpartisan. We've never endorsed a candidate, and we're not going to endorse a candidate now.
When I was doing some reading, also, one of the things that you look at as important is something that John Edwards has talked about. Now, John Edwards is out of this race, which is that we essentially have a bifurcated economy here, and that for the mass of people at the bottom, the opportunity is not arising, education isn't reaching them, and any training that's offered is not enough.
Well, that's true, and I think John Edwards is not the only person who says that. Many others do. It was gratifying to hear him raise it to the presidential level. I do wish that candidates Clinton and Obama, and the Republican candidates for that matter, had chosen to harp on this issue a little more than they have. It's fair to say that with the exception of Mike Huckabee, none of the Republicans sees anything wrong with the economy, and Hillary Clinton don't, to my satisfaction, talk about it enough.
What would they be needing to talk about? What would a policy look like that you think would start to begin to bridge that divide?
Well, in terms of actual policy, of course, repealing the Bush tax cuts, that's the number one item in putting our economy back together. You know, you read the reports on the newspapers on yesterday, those people who say we may get into a depression or a worse economic situation, they're predicting something that's already happened. You look at the housing market, you look at the unemployment figures, we're in worse shape now than we've been in recent months. And it seems to me the only way to get out of that shape is first to change administrations and to put in office someone who cares about putting the American people back to work, who cares about spending money on programs that help those down at the bottom. And that's got to be one of the candidates running right now.
Do you think that Super Tuesday, do you think that enough coalition building has been taking place among Obama, Clinton, McCain? Let's look at all of them in terms of reaching out and not pigeonholing not just black voters, but Hispanic voters, old voters. You know, I mean, are we seeing the kind of coalition building that you would hope to see that broadens a movement like you're describing?
No, not at all, at least not among the Republican candidates. I mean, they seem to be appealing to the very, very narrow, radically conservative Republican base and hope that if one of them emerges victorious from Super Tuesday, that he can then widen the base. Obama and Clinton, on the other hand, have always reached out to as broad a swath of Americans as they possibly can reach. Each of them has done it up to now, and if one of them emerges victorious, which is probably unlikely that one of them will claim the nomination, then he or she is going to do the same thing in the general election.
You think blacks and Hispanics are finding some common ground in this notion just overall, or are you concerned about some divisiveness arising out of what's happening?
Well, the very nature of elections is they're divisive. I'm for Joe and you're for Mary, so we disagree. But if you look at the past history of black and Latino voting, in election after election, in California for Tom Bradley, in Massachusetts for Deval Patrick, in Newark for Cory Booker, I mean, just go around the country. Wherever there's a black candidate who also represents a Hispanic constituency, that candidate has drawn strongly from both the black and the Hispanic voter list. So the idea that these two groups of people vote in opposition to each other, that's an entirely myth, I think, created by those who don't want them to vote together.
Who's creating those myths? I mean, who are those people that don't want people to vote together?
Well, there are people who say, I can get all the Hispanic votes, I can't get the black votes, so let me spread the rumor that Hispanics and blacks won't vote for the same people.
I guess I'm asking in part because of something I read one time, this notion that some black politicians have focused on the ability to get votes in their constituency and not, like you mentioned, Obama is doing or Bill Richardson was doing, to be ecumenical, reaching out beyond to try to get their values to the mainstream voter, to all the voters.
Well, I think there was a time in the past, say 25, 30 years ago, when a black man or woman who wanted to run for office chose a constituency that was overwhelmingly black. And if he or she could get a majority of those voters, they didn't have to worry about any other voters who might be in that district. But I do think times have changed, and a successful candidate, even running in a district that's overwhelmingly black, knows well enough that if he or she wants to go beyond that constituency, then they can't shut out any voters and can't let any voters feel like they're being shut out, they're not being talked to. So I do think we're in a new era. Again, I don't want to be too optimistic about it and think the country's changed too radically. But I do think both Obama and a handful of others represent some kind of new thinking. Look at Harold Ford in Tennessee. He almost became the United States Senator from Tennessee, and had there not been a last-minute hate ad run against him, he probably would have won. But he reached out to everybody in Tennessee and was very nearly almost successful.
Julian Bond is Distinguished Professor at American University in Washington, D.C., professor of history at the University of Virginia. Well, speaking of history, again, this notion that there is this large pool of people who aren't being reached by the rising tide or will be more hurt if there's an outgoing tide in this economy. Do leaders have the tools to reach those people, to provide the education, to provide the training, and then to integrate them into other parts of to bring them into where the jobs are?
I think some leaders have the capacity, and I know our system, our political system in the United States, has the capacity. The question is, can the leaders who have that capacity win office and win power? And then can they bend or change the system so that it delivers what's needed? And there's a question mark around both these questions. We just don't know.
We've had enough time to study it, haven't we?
I mean, we have, and we've always hoped. We've always thought the next election, the next time, the next candidate, they're going to be right. And all we can do is hope some more, hope that this election process we're going through right now produces people who can not only articulate the change and explain what's needed, but can make it happen. And that's the big challenge we all face.
What keeps it from happening? Do you think is it partisan? Is it structural?
Part of it's partisan, but, you know, I don't want to be too hard on partisanship. I believe in partisanship. I know there are people who disagree with me, and I disagree with them. Where there are points of agreement, we can and should be made to work together. But where there are honest disagreements, we ought not try to fudge these disagreements. I think George Bush has been a terrible president. About a third of the Republican population think he's been the greatest thing since sliced bread. I mean, there's no bridging that gap. But I do think that we can bridge these gaps. And again, all it takes is leadership.
You think there's when you talk to your students, white and black, this generation of students, is there a shift in commitment to leadership from 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
Well, I'd say 10 years ago. And yes, there is a shift. And I think we see it now. You see in Obama, and I don't want to hold any special brief for him because of the NAACP's nonpartisan status, he's getting an enormous number of young white people voting for him. This is a population that has been noted for great voter turnout in the past, and to see them turning out for him gives you hope. I don't know what the generational breakdown is for other candidates, but at least for this candidate, it's impressive.
When you were in the 60s and it was part of the protest era, nonviolence was, of course, a big part of what you were about. You were the one of the organizers of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We had this shift away from nonviolence as a tactic, maybe even as a philosophy. What was lost back then, if anything, or was it a necessary shift? And if it was or wasn't, how does it, well, first that part. What was lost?
I think we lost the ability to use what had proven to be an overwhelmingly effective weapon. If you just look at this quick snapshot of the 1960s when the Southern Civil Rights Movement practiced nonviolence, wholesale nonviolence, massive marches, protests, demonstrations, sit-ins, those kinds of things, they changed the whole country. And they could have adopted this technique to other changes needed in our country, but for various reasons they didn't do it, so we lost that.
And today, I mean, is there a tactic, is there an approach that's missing that, you know, that could have come out of that, or a generation that lost that tactic? I mean, where's the leadership coming from among the black middle class, the white middle class, the committed up and down the economic spectrum? I mean, where's their tool by which they get committed?
Well, nonviolence, remember, is only one of the tools that the movement of the 1960s used. It also used the political system. There are people who came out of the civil rights movement of the early 1960s who got elected to public office. I'm one of those people. I got elected in 1965 in the middle of the movement as the movement changed slightly from the confrontational protest tactics to political tactics. So I think there's an abundant number of leadership figures in both black and white young America. Some of them we know, young Jesse Jackson Jr., for an example, the congressman from Chicago, is one such figure. He's proud of saying that he's his father's son, but he's not his father's boy, and he goes about things in different ways than his father did. The two men, of course, have the natural affection of father and son, but they're different people. And I think you'll find different people doing these things than you would have then.
You told Henry Louis Gates, Julian Bond, you told him that I think we have a crisis of leadership and followership, that it works both ways. Do we still have that crisis?
Yes, and I think we always will have it. That's not to say we don't have leaders. It's not to say we don't have followers. But making the connection between Group 1 and Group 2, the leaders and the followers, has always been our challenge. There have been leaders in the past. There are leaders today who are visionary, who see an America that many people don't see. If they can only connect with a sufficient followership, as both all of the candidates in both parties are trying to do now, then we can have some change. It'll be either great change or it may be change for the worse.
Where would you focus your attention if you were there, if you were partisan? Where would you focus is the great wound no longer racism? Is the great wound now this gap between the haves and the haves a lot?
Well, of course it's racism. Racism still persists. We see it in our daily newspaper headlines. We see it in individual interactions. You see it in this rash of nooses that have been hung in various kinds of places. That's still here, very much a part of American history and American present day. But it doesn't have quite the force it once had. It hadn't gone away. So I think we're moving forward. I tend to be an optimist. I think things are getting better. They're not getting better at the pace I want, but they are getting better.
Do you miss the partisanship? Do you wish you could be running for office or making those speeches?
Not running for office, but I wish I could be taking sides. I wish I could be saying, vote for Joe, don't vote for Mary, vote for Frank, don't vote for Lester. I wish I could be out there in the hustings doing that.
But you have other people who are doing it for you, at least.
Indeed so. Indeed so.
And when you look back on your whole career, I know this is sort of one of those last questions that are easy to skim over, but when you look back on your whole career, is there something you missed that you would look back, you would do again, that you didn't do the first time?
Surely. I think had I to do it over again, and were I back in the Georgia legislature in the late 60s, early 1970s, that I would have been a different kind of person. I think I would have reached out more to my white constituents in my district, and I tried to do that, but I don't think I did it hard enough or well enough. I would have been more cooperative with my white colleagues in the Georgia House and the Georgia Senate. I would have tried to build the interracial democracy that Dr. King spoke about so pointedly, and I didn't work at that hard enough.
Of course, they would have had to have been willing to receive that gesture.
Of course so, but I think some of them were. But I think part of the responsibility lay with me, reaching out to them and hoping they'd reach out to me.
Not always an easy thing to make that mind, that transition, is it?
No, it's not.
Dr. Bond, I appreciate you talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Julian Bond is chair of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He is also the distinguished professor at American University in Washington, D.C., serving as professor of history at the University of Virginia. Speaking tonight, Kane Hall, room 130, 7 p.m., about leadership, about the civil rights movement. This is KUOW 94.9.
It's 10:39, KUOW 94.9 News and Information.
Support for KUOW comes from Wu Sing Dao School of Acupuncture, presenting a Chinese New Year celebration, dragon dance, and open house Saturday, February 9th from 2 until 4:30 p.m. Family activities and tours will be available. Details online at wuhsing.org.
38 degrees overcast in Seattle. Today's high 43. We're expecting rain this afternoon.
One issue where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have significant differences is health care. I'm Ross Reynolds. We'll explain the differences and find out which plan you like best on The Conversation at 1 p.m. on KUOW 94.9.
We want to know what you think. Should health insurance be mandatory, as Hillary Clinton proposes, or voluntary, as Barack Obama wants? Call The Conversation's feedback line at 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663, and then listen to the program this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Consolidated Press, serving Seattle since 1934, specializing in bound products, including magazines, catalogs, and books. Consolidated Press, 206-447-9659, or on the web at conspress.com.
Coming up at 11 o'clock, after the Super Tuesday votes have been counted, what happens next? We're talking about that in 20 minutes.
And now, Weekday presents another edition of Listener's Forum, starring you.
What happens next is that all eyes turn to Washington State. Well, most eyes. They'll be going to Louisiana, too. Because Washington State's caucuses, now a big part of the decision on who will get, especially the Democratic nomination. So this road to the White House is taking a long detour up through I-5 and all across Washington State, which brings us to our question. Now the caucus matters. Now it's not just something academic. You are going to be caucusing. You're going to be making some decisions. You're going to have to be going, making sure you know where your caucus is and showing up at 1 o'clock on Saturday to your caucus and your precinct. Well, what are you going to say? What are you going to do now? What do you learn from not just what Julian Bond just told us? What do you learn from last night's outcomes around the country, and what does it mean for Washington State? And what do we want to hear from these candidates about Washington State politics in particular? So your analysis of what happened last night, what you're looking for from the candidates, and what you're going to say at the caucus, what you're going to say to your fellow caucus-e, and is there something that they should say about Washington State? 206-543-5869 is our number, 1-800-289-5869. Please give us a call, 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. And, of course, you can also email us. Name of the show is Weekday, and our email address is weekday@kuow.org. Mike, by the matter of fact, writes us, when will the candidates be here? I can't find any info on Obama or Clinton sites. It would be great to know, and if KUOW could announce it and the site, that would tell me when candidates will be in town. Barack Obama's campaign says he'll visit Seattle on Friday. Hillary Clinton's campaign says Bill Clinton will visit tomorrow and Tacoma on Friday. I don't know that they've exactly picked the exact place yet, but we will find out over the next few minutes to know exactly where those candidates will be showing up. Barack Obama will visit on Friday. Hillary Clinton's campaign says Bill Clinton will visit tomorrow and Tacoma on Friday. The Washington caucuses are on Saturday. Democrats select all their delegates on Saturday. Republicans select half their delegates for the nominating conventions through caucus on Saturday. Then they will be voting in the Republican primary. Those Republican folks who declare as Republicans will vote in the Republican primary February 19th. There's also a Democratic primary, but it is a beauty contest, though perhaps folks who are interested in beauty contests will claim victory for that. So that's that. We'll give you more information. If we find out where it is exactly, we'll announce it, and we'll look, oh, producer, over the next few minutes if you have a chance to find out exactly where they're going to be. Another email, Michael, a longtime Democrat. I see the situation today paralleling that of 40 years ago in 68 with another foolish war as a backdrop. The leading Democrats were Hubert Humphrey, Bobby Kennedy. Hillary Clinton is our Humphrey. Both are tied to foolish wars, Vietnam, Iraq. Both represent the past. Both are tied to the old Democratic machine. Barack Obama is our Kennedy. Both have the courage to lead the opposition to the foolish war. Both represent the future. Both represent a new, young Democratic Party. In 68, an assassin's bullet made sure we'll never know how different things would have been if Bobby Kennedy had been elected. Humphrey got the nomination. Nixon, John McCain, defeated the baggage-laden Humphrey, Clinton. We all know the rest of the story. In 2008, do you finally remember Humphrey? Do you finally remember Kennedy and wonder what might have been? In Barack Obama, we have a chance to find out what might have been. John writes, I've been voting as a Democrat for 40 years. I'm going to my first caucus this Saturday supporting Senator Barack Obama over Mrs. William Jefferson Clinton. The two main reasons for my support of Senator Obama are, first, he is a true anti-war candidate, and secondly, he brings vitality and truthiness to the primary. You know, it'll be interesting to see in terms of the caucuses if the breakout of demographics mirrors what happened in the rest of the country. More educated, white voters going for Obama, blue collar or middle class voters going for Hillary Clinton. Bruce is in Port Orchard. Bruce, what are you going to say at your caucus?
Well, I'm really annoyed with the Democrats for deciding that they're not going to take into account the results of the primary. Republicans have agreed, as you said, to allot something like 50% of their delegates based on the primary, and the Democrats have decided to allot none. So what I'm going to do is introduce a written resolution to my precinct which will then go to the county, to a county level Democrat committee, which will decide what to do with the resolutions. So I'm encouraging everyone to do that, to write a resolution saying you want 51% of the delegates to be apportioned on the basis of the primary. And incidentally, I sent you a copy of my resolution. I don't know if you can put it on the web, but it would be nice if you could.
I think that'd be politicking, wouldn't it? Let me look for it. Is it Bruce? Bruce Bowden, caucus primary. Yeah, there it is. Are you going to take part in the caucus as well, or are you going to register a protest?
I'm absolutely going to take. This will be my second caucus. I've been a precinct committee officer and looking forward to it. They've streamlined the process so people don't have to expect to spend several hours there. Part of the streamlining was to get rid of these resolutions. But it shouldn't take much more than half an hour or an hour, I think they said.
All right, Bruce, I appreciate your call. Thanks a lot. And we'll take a look at that. We'll see what the folks think. We're taking your calls about analysis of this Super Tuesday, but also now that Washington State's going to be right in the bullseye and matter, are you caucusing? Are you more energized? And what do you need to know when you go there? Lena's in Redmond. Hi, Lena.
Hi, Steve.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My whole family's going out to caucus this Saturday, and we're going for Senator Obama.
Your whole family's going?
Yep. and I wanted to tell you that there are multiple reasons we're going to support him, but the one I want to highlight is I'm Arab-American, and I have the perspective of knowing what my relatives who live in the Arab world think of the U.S., and I can tell you that if Senator Obama became our next president, that would do a lot to restore respect and trust in the name of this country. And I'm not convinced the same would happen if Hillary Clinton became president.
So do you know how he stands, for example, on Pakistan? Have you looked at some of his positions on some of these emerging issues in that region? And is that driving your vote as well?
I have, and, his positions are not dramatically different, sort of point for point. It's his approach and his tone that is really moving to people. He has this idea that you should talk to all world leaders, your allies and your enemies, which, I can't believe it's revolutionary, but it is. And he never voted for the war, and it's such a big deal. It's not just a minor point. It's not like it was, some random little error on the part of Senator Clinton to vote for a war. It shows a perspective and a way of passing judgment that, frankly, I'm deeply uncomfortable with. And the fact that he never would have supported this war makes an enormous difference.
Lena, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
And bring that little one to caucus, too. I don't know if they can count that or not.
I'm bringing them all.
Lena, thanks a lot. We're getting your sense of this. Tell me what this tells you, but a lot of our calls so far, a lot of Obama supporters. So a shout-out to the other supporters, McCain supporters, Romney supporters, Paul supporters, Clinton supporters. What are you going to be looking for at this caucus now that Washington State matters? Are you going up and down the street now making sure everybody caucuses? All registered voters who are 18 at the time of the election can vote at their caucus. So that means if you're 17 and will be able to vote by November, you can go. You can register to vote at the caucus. You can vote in the caucus. You do have to declare your party when you go. So when you sign in, you have to declare to be a registered voter. And I take that back, folks. I'm wrong. Washington State does not require a voter to register by party. So you do not. Excuse me for being a messenger of misinformation. You do not have to register when you go. That's what it says right there on the Democratic site. Washington State does not require a voter to register by party. So you can go, and you must be registered in your precinct that you're caucusing in. If you've moved in, you can re-register at your precinct. And if you have other options, if you've recently moved, you can go back to your old precinct. You can bring your kids to your caucus as well, even though they can't be voting. And you don't need to bring ID to the caucus, but when you sign in, you're asked to declare that you're a Democrat and a registered voter. Well, that seems contradictory, Democrats. You have to declare you're a Democrat, you just don't have to register as by party. All right. Lamont's in Bremerton. Hi, Lamont.
How you doing?
I'm very good. Are you can't caucus this Saturday? Why not?
Absolutely. I'll be leaving town on Friday night for military business. And I think, this kind of disenfranchises us for those of us who are finally getting to see a great primary season where, we're getting a vote or two caucuses will be in the primary when it actually matters. We don't already have it locked up.
All right, I have to stop you there, because guess what? There are only three reasons you can vote in the caucus without being there. If you serve in the military, have a medical condition, or for religious reasons, you can't attend the caucus. Sounds like you qualify. You download their caucus surrogate affidavit form, and you have to return this form by 5 p.m. on February 1st. Oh, well.
Exactly, see? And only when you go to someplace like KUOW do you find out that information, even if it's too late. You only hear about caucusing, and they give you the date and the time. And, you know, even people who will be in town say, can I commit that time to go and to that location?
Yeah, well, to be fair, I mean, the Democrats have it on their website. I'm just reading the Washington State Caucus FAQ on their website.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you like, Lamont?
I actually like Ms. Clinton. I don't know enough about Barack Obama. He hasn't been around enough. And it seems to me, by what I can see, I've read both his books, and I've actually listened to a lot of his campaigns. I am an African-American man myself, but couldn't vote for him just because he's another black guy. But I see, it seems to me that he comes down and makes his vote after he knows what side to fall on. There's too many times he just wouldn't vote. He either didn't vote yes or no, or he just vote present. And I just say, wow, you had a lot of times to let people know what your opinions are, and you wait to figure out which side of the fence to be on afterwards.
Now, let me ask you some analysis from you. What do you think about this surge? Oh, I shouldn't use that. This rise in his vote getting and his popularity over the past few weeks. I mean, you see it in New Mexico. You saw it in California, that he is gathering more listeners. There's momentum up until Super Tuesday. We'll see how it goes after that. Does that tell you anything about Obama as a candidate or Obama as a politician?
18 to 25. I would go see a movie just because there were black people in it, no matter how bad it was. So I see that with a lot of young voters. They're bandwagon jumpers. I actually know a lot of people who say, I'm going to vote for Barack Obama to prove I'm not a racist.
Interesting.
Like, I go, wow, that's weird. You know, I meet a lot of people now that I'm retired out of the Navy. I still talk to a lot of Navy people, realtor, and I talk with people who tell me, I am voting this way because it's great to be able to vote for a black guy. And I go, well, what do you like about him? Well, I'm not a racist. Well, what do you like about him? Well, I think it's time that America proves that we can vote for a black person. And I go, wow, thank you very much.
Lamont, yeah. you have to read Shelby Steele's book. We talked to Shelby Steele last week, and he talked about Obama just in that same language. You should check out his book. It was called A Bound Man.
Program.
Yeah.
I listened to the program and actually tried to call in doing it because I agree with him why there are so many people who are voting now for so many reasons. I mean, I also know people who tell me I should vote for Barack Obama because I'm black and a man, but then I don't get women who say I'm going to vote for Hillary Clinton just because she's another woman.
Yeah. All right, Lamont. I appreciate your call. I don't mean to cut you off, but I want to get some other calls as well. But I appreciate your call and safe journeys.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let me go to Shahnawaz. Am I saying your name right?
Yes, Shahnawaz.
Shahnawaz. What about yourself? Are you caucusing?
Yes, this is the second time I'll be caucusing, and there is no doubt that this. I think you in the beginning you mentioned something that we will be voting for the Washington State issues. I think
I was just saying, what Washington State issues would you like to hear the candidates address, or would you bring up when you caucus?
Yeah, basically what I think, this is the time that we should think of whole world, not only Washington State. So I think my choice, obviously I'm going for the Democrats. It's the second time. I'm still confused between Obama and Clinton, because what my choice is that in the foreign affairs matters, we should look for a candidate which is least corruptible. Because I think what they call foreign affair lobbies, or I call them foreign affair mafias, they are playing big roles for the last many decades in the Middle East politics. I think we should have the candidate who should not get influenced by those lobbies. And I think that should be our first choice. And still I'm confused. I'm happy that Obama has asked to end the war quickly. But at the same time, how much he will be influenced by those people in the future, we have to pay attention to that. And I'm still not sure which candidate to go, but I'm definitely going. I'm still working on who shall we go for. I'm just still studying.
You're going to be milling around in the middle there, going to each group.
Yeah, and I have to actually ask the questions, and still I'm searching the internet who I think is least corruptible. I think that should be our main criteria. We are making a history, obviously, this year, either having a woman president or a black American president, which is good. This will prove to the world that America is a great nation. We're above all these gender and race differences. But at the same time, like the previous caller mentioned, we have to be very honest what they are for, because at this time, whole world is in turmoil, and we real honest people.
Hey, Shanawaz, I appreciate you calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, we're taking your calls on the caucus pretty quickly. Dorothy in Olympia, hello.
Hello.
What about yourself?
Well, I'd like to be at a caucus, but I'm of an age that is awkward to be there.
Now you didn't know about being able to download this caucus surrogate form?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I don't. They didn't advertise that enough.
And it's too late, isn't it now?
Well, all right. So here, you listen on. We have another caller who's gonna answer that question, I think. Now, according to what I'm reading on the Democrats' website, you must return this form by 5 p.m. on February 1st. Let me, Beryl in Seattle.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify that there have been two forms floating around. One had a February 1st deadline and one had a February 8th deadline. I happen to be a volunteer with the Obama campaign, and if people call the office at 206-529-3859, ask for Nathan, he will be able to email you the correct form at this point, which has a deadline of February 8th.
At the bottom of the form, it says, a copy of this form properly completed and signed must be sent by mail, fax, or a scanned PDF to the Democratic Party headquarters no later than February 1st, so that the form may be forwarded to the proper local party organization by Saturday, February 9th. But you're saying it's different.
That's what we've been told at the Obama headquarters. That's what we're operating under.
What was that number again?
It is 206-529-3859, and ask for Nathan.
All right, Beryl, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we'll real quickly, because I'm just about out of time, but Ebony in Bellevue, you're going for Clinton?
We are. Our whole family, my husband, my daughter, and I, we're headed to the caucus. It'll be our second year caucusing, and Hillary Clinton all the way.
And all right, we'll be listening for you, making those points when you're at the caucus. Thanks a lot. Well, all right, that was good, folks. Thank you. Get a little taste of what's going on and a little bit of information. We'll dig around a little more and find out about the issue of the surrogate form if you can't attend the caucus. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell with David Hyde, Jenny Asarno, Irene Noguchi, Bernard Ouellette. I'm Steve Scherer. This is KUOW Seattle.
It's 10:59.
One issue where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have significant differences is health care. I'm Ross Reynolds. We'll explain the differences and find out which plan you like best on The Conversation at 1 p.m. on KUOW 94.9.
Should health insurance be mandatory, as Hillary Clinton proposes, or voluntary, as Barack Obama wants? Call The Conversation's feedback line at 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. And then listen to The Conversation this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Michelle Mendoza, what's happening with traffic this hour?
Well, northbound 5 drivers near 516 may be just a bit slow, but they have cleared out an earlier car fire. Folks are starting to make it their way through that area now. Gusty winds on the Narrows and also on White Pass. Now, keep in mind, traction tires are required in Stevens, Snoqualmie, and White Pass as well. Just heard word that there is furniture. On northeast 145th, the ramp to southbound I-5, please use extra care in that area. This report, a service of Toyota Certified Used Vehicles. I'm Michelle Mendoza on KUOW.
Thank you, Michelle. 38 degrees, overcast in Seattle. Today's high, 43. We're expecting rain. And then overnight, a low of 39 degrees. Windy and rainy overnight as well. Bernard Ouellette, 94.9 KUOW News and Information. Broadcasting 3 channels in HD and streaming worldwide at KUOW.org.